healthy things grow, growing things change. And that's where the change in methodologies and keeping very open-handed about, you know, how you do things. Change forces you to trust God. Trust always leads to obedience. Obedience makes you healthy, and healthy things grow. So it's a cyclative in nature.
Well, hey, friends, it's Jason, and I want to thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Canadian Church Leaders Podcast. As I'm recording this greeting, we are on Keats Island off the coast of Vancouver with a contingent of pastors from all across Canada, from Ontario, from Manitoba, from Alberta, from British Columbia, for a CCLN and Barnabas retreat. And it's just been stunning. This morning, we got to hear from Mark Buchanan and sweet time of worship. And the best part has just been building friendships and connection with pastors from different churches and denominations and parts of our country. And we're hosting a gathering like this again in November. So if you'd ever like to join us in person for one of our retreats, you can find out more on our website. Today, we have the opportunity of hearing a conversation with a Canadian pastor, Jonathan Smith. Jonathan has over 30 years of leadership and pastoral experience leading churches in Halifax, Montreal, and Toronto. He's currently the lead pastor of One Church TO. And we covered a lot of ground in this conversation. We talked about what it looks like to lead a congregation lovingly through change. We talked about how the health of the leader impacts the health of the congregation. We talked about how even our spirituality and spiritual rhythms change from season to season in our life. And we talked about raising up the next generation of pastors and leaders, what it looks like to cover them, advocate for them, and give opportunity in a healthy, meaningful way. I loved my conversation with Jonathan, and I'm looking forward to you getting to hear it yourself. But before we jump in, let's hear from our partners at the Canadian Bible Society.
I want to thank our friends at the Canadian Bible Society who make this episode possible. We want to highlight a resource they developed called the Bible Course, a course that was created to help the average person engage with God's Word in a deeper way. The Bible Course includes 8 weeks of video teaching that are all designed to connect the events, books, and characters of Scripture together into one big story. This course can easily be run in small groups and even is a great follow-up to something like Alpha if you're running that. To check out the first video for free and to learn more about the course, just head to BibleSociety.ca/the Bible Course and you'll find all you need. That's BibleSociety.ca/the Bible Course.
Well, Jonathan, what a gift to have this time together. You're laughing because we just chatted for a while and then we have to start as if we're starting from scratch, like, oh, surprised to see you here.
Good to see you, Jason.
Yeah. I would love for those that don't know you, just to give us a little bit of like, what are the big building blocks that have your imagination and fill your weeks these days?
Probably my role, lead pastor, great church in Toronto. I think a lot of the passion pieces comes from leading dynamic teams. I like high-performing and deep-forming teams. That's what we call them, high-performing and deep-forming. Hmm. And I love health. And I think healthy teams build healthier churches. So I spend a lot of my time on staff development, wellness evaluations, as well as kind of organizational strategy.
Hmm. Tell us a bit more about One Church Toronto. I know that this is a church that you didn't start, you inherited it, it had a life mm-hmm. before you. And I have a personal fascination with like any church over 30 years old in Canada, I'm fascinated with, because we're a young country. Right. And we, you know, it's not like walking through the streets of the UK where you see this church has been here for hundreds of years. But we do have some churches with some deep history that I think helps place us as pastors today in a much bigger story. Mm-hmm. And so tell us a bit about the story of what's now called One TO.
Yeah, it's called One Church TO, but I think if you're going to tell their story, you probably have to tell the story of how it changed over the years. But it's over 65 years old, 75 nationalities in it. I followed just some great pastors who are faithful to the end. And I think it's kind of unique in our context. When I first came back from Montreal and transitioned back to Toronto to lead this church, I had the two previous lead pastors attending our church.
Wow.
I mean, just speaks to the health of them and the health of their tenure and their leadership. One man has since gone on to be with the Lord. Stuart Mulligan was his name, and Keith Smith. And he's still part-time on our staff as a teaching pastor, but no relation to me, but I worked with him as his associate a number of years before. And I think the church is obviously multicultural, but multi-generational. Hmm. And we really put a premium stock on that. Like, we find the generational sticky points aren't as congruent as we wish they were. Hmm. And I think that's what we've worked really hard to make sure we're an entire family sitting around the table. All the generations are well represented around the table. So that's a little picture. I love this church.
How long ago did you step into the lead role there?
I'd say probably it was a unique transition. So when I came back, Keith Smith was still the lead pastor, and I came on for a year as a co-lead with him. Hmm. And then the congregation voted. This is kind of how our movement works. And I was elected as lead pastor, and there was 1 year still of co-leading after. And then I became the lead pastor. So I think it'd be over 6 years now. Years as the lead here. Yeah.
Wow. Do you remember what your vote was? What percentage affirmation?
I don't. It was good, and they knew me because I had been their associate pastor for about 9 years in a previous era, which was very interesting because I think because they knew me, I think it was harder. In some respects, when I begin to challenge some of where we have been, and maybe even some of our we were leaking younger generations, so we made a lot of modifications and changes. And I think that was really hard on people who know me for years.
Yeah,
but I had really stepped under and was working in congruency with the previous lead. I wanted to make sure I stayed in step with him. Mm. And we share the same values, a lot of same philosophy, but we'd have a different probably... rate of change and speed of change. And I'd probably be on the upper end of that.
Yeah.
And so I think it was a reclimatizing to someone they had known, but someone they had to learn as the lead.
Oh, man. I admire Pentecostals for so many reasons. Courage and evangelism, an amazing history, empowering people, and standing in front of their congregation, letting them vote. It's terrifying. Yeah. But I love it. And I know, like, I have lots of friends that's part of their journey. And on the other side of that vote, you're voted in. And obviously there's thoughtfulness and there's communication with the board and there's a transition. It's mm-hmm. obviously there's a lot of intentionality to it. But you're beginning at that point thinking through, what's my mandate here? Mm-hmm. And understanding where the church has been, having a real love and affection, I hear, in you for the people.
But
a conviction that in love, we need to lead to a future that doesn't look exactly like the present. Just begin us to kind of take us into that place of, like, how are you assessing what's happening in that church? And how are you making sense of what steps to take when, as a new leader, trying to lovingly do a change journey for this congregation?
When I came back, I sat down with every member of the leadership, all the staff, custodians, everybody, and I asked them, I interviewed them, I spent time with them. What do you love about this church? What's not working? What do you hope changes? What do you hope never changes? And my goodness, just by pausing and taking time to listen and not assuming I knew everything that was going on, because I kind of knew them. That was really helpful, and that helped design a little bit of what it affirmed a lot of things I thought I saw.
Yeah.
And then I did a ton of metrics work. And, you know, I have a little saying, in church world, we often make decisions off anecdotal data when we should be making decisions off actual data. And anecdotal data kind of are the stories we tell that fuel vision. They're powerful. I love them. But I found, at least in our context, maybe it's more my tribe too, even, Jason, to be fair, it might be more of a Pentecostal thing. We made a lot of decisions off good stories. There's a story
it's
of life changing.
It's not
here.
Just you guys. Okay, it's not just you guys. It's all of us.
We just and so we had lots of good stories, and we were bleeding. We were bleeding emerging generations. It was all covered, I think, too, because economically, like, our finances were great. But I do a lot of survey work. I do a lot of that. I love the back end data part. And I saw that we were aging out. And I knew that we could have some hard conversation now or some really, really hard conversations in 10 years when the boomers retire.
Yeah.
Because they were carrying the freight.
Yeah.
And I decided to have the hard conversations early.
Obviously, the broader context is what you're describing there for your particular church is actually a much larger story of, you know, I think there's a recent book published with US data called like the Great De-Churching and all these different ideas. And I think that while it would be different than the US data, there would be some real mirrored modeling in the Canadian context. And how are you on a personal level, and you're not just thinking about your church, but the church in Canada, you know, what are the questions you're asking or what are the convictions that you're leading with? If we're going to ask the question, like, how do we do ministry today in such a way that actually seeds a likely fruitful future 20, 30 years down the road?
Like, I think we have a little saying on staff, walk towards the mess. I think as we engage with emerging generations, and we've just seen such a massive turnaround there, and that's not hyperbole. It's been pretty incredible to see what God has done. But I realized it's only been as we have been willing to be vulnerable and uncomfortable and have those hard conversations and walk towards the difficult passages and the difficult touch points that I'm on Twitter, you know, you can see the culture war of evangelicals on Twitter, and it's just embarrassing at times to watch this, brothers and sisters, how they speak to each other, all of those things. We're less into making statements as much as we are of having postures. And what is our posture going to be towards this community? What is our posture going to be towards this? And so people want to make it about issues, but these issues are all attached to people, human beings made in God's image. So we're going to value the person over the position, and we're going to try to take the posture of Christ in that. And so part of that journey has been, as we kind of try to open up the funnel to reach more Torontonians, we're very committed to the depth of disciple making. Because I do think if you're really doing that well, people are going to fight us if we're not reaching new people, instead of trying to protect what was. And, you know, the age-old mission, message, methods kind of conversation. We determined a long time ago that we are going to try to open up people's fists around the methods and keep that very open-handed and flexible. Because that's the only way that we can stay culturally connected to what's going on in our world and yet not move away from the principal mission or the message, the gospel that Christ has given us. I think when it comes to the methods, I guess I was quite shocked, and I think I have been. I'm a little idealistic as a human being of how attached people are to methods and willing to shelve the mission, and even willing to edit the message as long as we can hold on to our methods. So I think probably the most conflict I've led through is dealing with methodologies, because they've been, you know, I guess elevated to such a place. And I, you know, and when we were in the middle of a pandemic, we were seeing a lot of stuff come out of people in our church, and I gathered our kind of ministry team, and I just said, you know, you can point fingers at people, but these are the disciples we produced. So we tore down everything and took a long, hard look at how we were actually discipling. And it was really painful and embarrassing for us to pull back the curtain and say, listen, we've run great gatherings. I'm not sure we've developed great disciples. And I don't want to blame people for that. I feel like as a leader, that's within, I'm the one with the microphone. You get what you allow and you get what you shape. And we thoughtfully, and I'm so proud of the team. Like, this is a cumulative work of lots of people. We developed something called follow, and you know, people in our church take a follow assessment to see where they are, what are the spiritual disciplines that they'll get into this year. And we have follow Sundays. We have all kinds of stuff to do that. But I recognize at the back end, you know, you need, if the funnel is going to be, the larger the funnel is, the more narrow and deeper the roots of the discipleship process needs to be. So that it leads back to the funnel. and the funnel leaps,
okay,
goes
take,
into it.
Take me deeper into that. Like when you, what, just tell me more about the model. Give me a bit more language. Well, you're saying like broad, okay, like inviting lots of people in, you mean like people who don't know the Lord?
Like, okay. So I have this little working model of ministry I've used since I was a church planner in my early 20s. Healthy things grow. And that's not necessarily, it's maturity. It means in every way, healthy things grow. Growing things change. They always change. Something that grows change. And that's where the change in methodologies and keeping very open-handed about, you know, how you do things. Change forces you to trust God. You have to hold on to something that doesn't change in a dynamic culture and a dynamic moment, or your human nature will stop the change. So, you know, change forces you to trust God. Trust always leads to obedience. Obedience makes you healthy, and healthy things grow. So it's a cyclical in nature. So I think when we think of opening up the funnel, like one of our five bold moves was to reach 1 million Torontonians digitally per year. And it's with touch points. And we did that. We did that the first year. We built a digital team, and they're phenomenal. They help us because of our digital expression. The funnel's gotten bigger and bigger, and people are connecting more and more. We know that if that funnel's going to be large, and if we're not careful, we have big crowds that really don't, at the end of the day, I don't think once the church gets hit or shook in this world, that what will be left? What will be left? And so we're really intentional. Everyone on that funnel side knows their mission is to connect people. We call it stacking. So we have this thing called stackable in our staff structure and ministry ethos. Everything stacks. So they need to stack into all our discipleship processes. Everything has a next step. Everything has an entry point, and everything has an exit point to maintain momentum in our church, but also to make sure people are going deeper into those spiritual disciplines and become more rooted, so that they too want to be a part of filling that funnel. So that's what I mean about that funnel, that we work hard to kind of manage, and we recognize there's been seasons where we need to spend more time on the opening the funnel up. There's been seasons where we realize we need to we have leaders dare, pastors care kind of thing. We need to make sure that the pastors in our organization are telling the leaders in them to have a seat, because they need to do the deep work on developing those that have come into our church. And then at some point, we'll tap them on the shoulder and say, hey, can you tell the pastor to have a seat so the leaders can start to dare to open up that funnel even more? I don't know if this makes sense to you, but it does in our ecosystem.
I love it. Well, I really just appreciate you taking the time to unpack it. And I also just love the way God's uniquely graced you to think about these models and these frameworks. It's just wonderful to experience and to hear. And I know you care so deeply about the health of your team and the health of your congregation. And I think that care is expressed in the nuances and subtleties of that model. I loved earlier when you talked about this idea of just that simple, like how things grow, growing things change. And I'm always trying to look for metaphors that help me make sense in my world, whether it's a biblical metaphor or something. Just something, I need a picture, like, or, you know, you talk about models and you know, we talk about church building. You know, I was thinking like, oh, I wonder if sometimes we think like Lego set when we think church building, like there's a clear outcome. We got to get the pieces. Sometimes it's complicated. And I was like, oh, it's probably a lot more like church building is probably not the right metaphor of like construction. It's probably more like garden tending, like ecosystem tending. Like on the best day, you've got a real part to play as the pastor. Like you're setting conditions. You're creating parameters, you're pulling things back, you're planting things, but ultimately there's this living ecosystem that is the life of a people of God in a place that's affecting a city in a salty way. But we're not hands off, but it's not the same as like framing a house. It's more, you know, maybe like tending a dynamic ecosystem. I just love to hear what you think, like how you make sense of those different pictures we use to make sense of our role as pastor.
So I love that analogy. I read a book years ago. I think it was called The Trellis and the Vine or something. I think it's Church of England book. And it really helped form a little bit more of that gardener aspect of me, because capitalism, success-driven church, is so tempting and ego-gratifying and so dangerous. And I'm not taking a swing at anyone. I'm taking a swing at me. that it helped me to move it away from up and to the right thinking to health and gardening thinking. And one of the things I think pastors struggle with in that analogy, I think they do love the feeding and the watering and the caring. They're not very good pruners. And every good garden only thrives with good pruning. And I think the metaphor must be, I think it was a Henry Cloud book or something I read years ago about a rose bush, you know, always produces way more buds than it can actually sustain and nourish. So, and in order to get really healthy roses, you need to clip back the buds, healthy buds even. And so we're very, we're ruthless with things around here, even things that are working. If they're not adding to, if they don't stack in that stacking analogy, if they're not stacking into what we're doing and where we're going, then they're taking away energy from where we're going. So you can't have one ministry that's the star ministry that's flowing and they're the success one. They're filling out a Sunday school room somewhere. If it's not feeding into something and it's not helping, if the all ships aren't rising, then it's probably taking away energy. And it's probably creating celebrity or a platform in some sort of way that we think long-term is less sustainable. So we're really into this idea of pruning lots. We pruned our staff down. We've worked hard at really trying to align things, simplify them. And that's because we got clarity about where we're going and that helped us.
You just really helped me, Jonathan. We've got this meeting coming up. We're a young church. We're doing our first, what would be...
I love what you guys are doing, by the way.
That's so, love it. So kind. And we're doing our first. It's our governance model doesn't have an AGM in the sense there are, you know, many, our board satisfies the requirements of the government as the member. So we do an AGM that's smaller, but we want to do a community meeting where people can ask questions and hear the finances. We're trying to take some of the best of what that model, the one more like what you might be part of, has and make that accessible. And so we're doing our... It's a big, big difference. Not an AGM, an ACM, an annual community meeting, and super cheeky. But one of the things and we're 3 years old, and a year and a half of that was during COVID. So, you know, people who've been part of our church for a while haven't had all the forums to ask questions. So, in the like sign up form for the event, you can submit questions, not anonymously, which was intentional, but they can. And there's been great questions, like such thoughtful people. But one of the questions that has come up a couple times was around, why don't you have a program for blank?
And
for each person, I bet the motivation, in some cases, sure, there could be a consumeristic aspect, but for some, it's quite missional. It's like they've got seniors in their life, or they've got young adults in their life, and they care, or they care about a certain cause in the city, you know, whatever it might be. And so, do you have something for blank? And what you just described about the rose bush really helped me because all of these things they describe, I can be compelled by. And there's a part of my pastoral heart that goes, yeah, that'd be awesome. And then there's this deep conviction. I think if we do all of the things, we'll end up probably doing very little well. And then it also bumps up against my ecclesiology a little bit, being like, if we do all of the things, then we maybe give into the lie that the gathered, organized church is the imprint of God in the city versus the scattered people making the city salty. But your rose bush analogy, I'm going to do that in front of everybody. And I'm going to say, some of you asked, and I'm going to talk about trimming rose buds. I'm going to do some research. And so thank you for helping me because I needed to figure out how I was going to answer that question. And now I've got an analogy to work with.
But it isn't it tempting? I think we do Working Genius on our staff. I love the tool.
Is that Pat Lencioni's new? Yes, I haven't read that yet.
Yeah. So I'm a galvanizer ideator.
Okay.
So, when someone comes to me with an idea, like people may approach you, why aren't we doing this? It's not hard for me to get energy around an idea. And there's a galvanizer. I want to help. I want to lead us, move us. But, you know, I can make a lot of messes because I'm an ideator and a galvanizer without good discernment along that process. So we get asked that a lot. And we have groups as our kind of backbone and delivery system for our whole discipleship models. But it means that we've said no more than people would like. I just dealt with something not too long ago in a little bit of a conflict because people were kind of underground starting stuff. And I get what they're going for, but I would say that there's a lot of that can be found in your community already. being done by good organizations. And what we built a plan around strategic partnerships instead of duplication. Again, keeping us focused on what we can do and then supporting the larger expression of God in our city. And I think your idea of the scattered church, like that's how we would see a church is not a gather. The church can be gathered, but we believe our church is deployed strategically. And they're the incarnational presence of Jesus in different boroughs and streets and apartment buildings and condo units and everything in our city and workplaces. And we want to so equip them that they are able to be salt and light in those places and spaces. But less is more in church world. And I think sometimes it's kind of like, I think sometimes I'm my own worst enemy. And I've seen it in a lot of leaders. Sometimes I've seen leaders cause a lot of messes because they're good at fixing messes. And I think they cause what makes them feel useful. And I've watched us overdo stuff, over sensationalize, over hype, over energize around something. And only until we lose interest in it. And then we go into a different direction. It's like a guy who comes back from a conference with a brand new idea, implement and you know, allowing people to vet into the discerning process and edit me has been so fruitful to have people that can do that in your ecosystem. Because I do think we have a tendency to want to, I want to help people. I want to help their make their dreams a reality.
Yeah, totally. You know, one thing I know about you is that you put a lot of care into the health and vitality of your leadership team, staff, but core volunteers. And you have a multi-generational staff. Which is really special. And that's a question I'm often asked, like, how do you work with, whether it's millennials or Gen Z, while also try to maintain, like on our staff, I think our youngest is probably maybe 20, our oldest is 76. And we're trying to do this together, which is very challenging at times, very rewarding. The benefit is just stunning, but it's costly. I'd love to know a little bit about what practices you put in place or postures might be the language that you'd use, but also some lessons you've learned along the way going after it.
I've learned what every leader's learned. It's easier to hire someone than to move someone. And people are incredibly valuable, fearfully, wonderfully made. I know everyone listening to this believes that. I wish we handled departures as well as we did arrivals. I see a lot of trauma around that. I wish I could say I've always been perfect at it. I just have learned to value the human being across the table from you. And so, you know, I think every staff member in our team has a wellness plan. They meet with a counselor outside of our organization twice a year just to do a checkup.
And do you guys fund that as well?
We do. We fund all that. Yeah. We're very committed to health on our team. Each staff member has a development plan. Personalized to who they are and where they're at and helping them take next steps. I want our staff to, I want other people to want to try to poach our staff. Because they're that good. They're just great. They're well-developed and they get to choose whether or not they want to be a part of our mission longer term. Or I've seen people over the years stop developing and they get stuck somewhere. And you know, there's no next step for them and they haven't taken the next step there. And that's a really problematic space to be in. And then everyone has an evaluation plan on our staff team. So wellness, development, evaluation. Most churches, and even when I was early in ministry, a lot of it was only around evaluation. You did your own development, you did your own wellness. And we just assumed you were all well.
Yeah.
And I just have my wife, my partner, Shelley, has been so helpful for me. I mean, we've been married over 30 years and she comes from a very rough family background. And I remember being shocked at something that was going on at the church with people that I knew. And I was just like, oh, I can't believe this. And she said, what do you mean you can't believe it? Like, I mean, I just can't believe people. I can't believe that nobody's sinning. I can't believe that nothing of this. I think it's the human condition. And we have this propensity. We're always gravitationally being pulled towards brokenness.
Yeah.
And that's really helped me to just be more compassionate. We all have our areas we walk with a limp, but I'm very committed to helping as long as a staff member wants to, and our deacons and our elders. We have a core leaders team at this church that includes all three groups: staff, elders, deacons. That they're the health of their family is paramount to us. We spend a lot of energy and time caring for kids, spouses, and them. It's the health of the family that matters. And then the individual, of course, in our staffing structure needs a measure of health, a measure of wholeness to make sure they're leading out of their brokenness, but not from their brokenness. Mm. If that makes sense, it's not being informed from the brokenness, but there's a humility. They recognize I'm not the full deal. Mm. I've got my areas, and there's a humility that you have to lead with when you hold on to that brokenness in one hand and you open it up for other people to inspect it in the other.
Yeah. I think it was in a pre-conversation earlier, you mentioned this idea of one of the realities of leadership, it'd be true in any context, in our case, pastoral leadership, is to see positive change, to see the people move in a direction together, there's going to be pain. Oh. And then I think you noted, and that's why the health of the leader is so important. Can you just speak to that on a personal level for you? Maybe how you've been exposed to pain through leadership and that caused you to see areas of unhealth within, and then maybe what you're doing proactively now in light of that.
I remember early in ministry, and that's a great question, Jason, but I remember being fired.
Hmm.
And it was really hard. It rocked my world. And it was a gut check moment. The ego is, and I just had gotten married. It was just a terrible, dark chapter.
Yeah.
I thank God for it so much now.
Hmm.
It forced me towards therapy. It forced me to have to open up to others. It forced me to have to recognize my own insecurities, my own competitiveness. And those were gifts. I think it was hard for Shelley to have to carry me through those seasons. And yeah. I went and I planted a church at 23 with that in my heart.
Hmm.
And that took some time to, I realized that initially a lot of the energy I used to plant that church was to prove somebody wrong, to prove it was not healthy.
Hmm.
And it created a workaholism in me, a success-oriented look at me type thing. And it took years to unravel some of that. And I think sometimes a lot of leaders get stuck with, we all have insecurities. And I think even some competitiveness between churches and between leaders. And I have little practices in my life that I try to do to make sure that I don't let those things take over, by celebrating people. It's amazing when you celebrate people, how it changes the tone of your expression, your thoughts towards them. I think flattening an organization and the leadership, accountability is such a great tool to help you stay in a healthy spot. Turning down social media, praying for other leaders and churches in your city. These are things I daily practice, and it's as much for them as it is for me.
Mm.
It kills a lot of that me monster in me when I can just applaud people that are winning outside my context and they're doing great work. When a friend gets noticed for something, and there's that little niggling thing in you that says, hey, wait, I was doing that.
Mm.
And to just applaud them and thank God for them. I think nobody's perfect at this, but you got to be so intentional.
Mm.
And again, I'll elevate, I just more recently went back to see a therapist again. And it was because I came out of COVID, and there was a lot of stuff that happened during COVID, and I saw a lot of ugliness and a lot of it was sticking to my spirit, and I saw it in the way I was leading again. And I thought, said, okay, no, I need to take serious my health so that I don't burden my organization with my unhealth. And so I think some of it wasn't obvious to other people, but it was obvious to me.
Hmm. Hmm. I was really struck by your reflection on being 23, planting a church. Oh. I mean, you're an incredibly gifted guy. No doubt that at 23, though you had no idea what quite is required, you're like, there's all this entrepreneurial force and creativity and gathering people. And I think it was just so impactful to hear you reflect, though, that some of the motives perhaps were mixed. And I think it's so interesting because I think a lot of people listening are early in ministry. They're in a second or third seat in a church. They see a lot of things they would do differently. They wish their voice was more heard. And then every once in a while, they've experienced stuff like, whether it's what you experienced or maybe even more unjustly, like found themselves ousted from an environment and they're asking, what am I supposed to do? Like, how do I honor God and this vision inside of me? And I'm just so curious, like what, maybe there was like a really healthy spiritual father or mother in your life at the time, or even now at the vantage point of time, how would you come alongside your 23-year-old self at that time?
I probably had not one person, it was probably a collection of people that I can look back now. And I just see how the Holy Spirit was architecting some things. I was ready to leave ministry, had applied to a university, was going to go back to my planned path in life, not the unplanned path of ministry. I remember a guy phoning me up out of the blue. He's a few years older than me, been in ministry for a while, called me, recognized the tone of my voice. Something's not right. He lived in another city. He got in his car, drove, and took me out for supper and confronted me and had me actually share what was going on. And that was a part of, I remember him just telling me, because I thought my world was done. And I remember him telling me, who do you think, and he named somebody, who do you think they are? Like, you know, we get in, and I think the church is like that, becomes a little echo chamber, and it becomes your world. And we're big on our staff being involved in their community, not just in the church community, because it's a big, big world that God's created, and we get a chance to engage with it and be around it. I would say to my 23-year-old self, it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. Learn your lesson from this moment. Pain is a great teacher. It opens doors that I would never, in my pride, allow to be pried open. But pain forced it open. And I'm glad I had a partner who was pushing me to walk through it, pushing me towards honesty about what was going on. And I, you know, I'm thankful for her, because she's always been somebody that I could be honest with about my pettiness, the smallness that can lurk beneath the surface. And I think, and she calls me to better things. So I'm thankful for that. We're very different. And it's amazing. Those 2 years too, our marriage was so tough. We were so different from each other. So we're fighting all the time. The church is trying to get planted. She has the same degree I do. It was a fascinating journey, but we're so different. And I think I would say to anyone 23 that was going through that, you need older people in your life. I had an area pastor when I was planting who just came and saw my church, and it was a very unconventional church for its time. It was, you know, no one in the church had attended a church before. And it was in the poorest section of Halifax, a regional municipality. It was in Dartmouth. And some people are listening, if you're from the north end of Dartmouth, you know exactly what I mean. You know, second generation, poverty, all kinds of things. And I love that church. I love those people. I gave my heart and soul and everything I could to them. But I had an area pastor show up at a Christmas thing we're doing, and he was so moved by the people that were gathered there. He said, listen, let me take you out to lunch, breakfast once a week. And he gave me John Maxwell tapes. We're going way back, Jason. I don't know the last time I read John. No diss to John, but I'd never thought of leadership. I'd never thought of a bunch of things. And these were way back. He was pastoring at Skyline, and he gave me cassette tapes. And he said, you listen to it this week, and at breakfast, I'm going to ask you questions. And he just, I had no money. I couldn't afford to eat out. Here he is taking me out for breakfast, having adult conversations about leadership. And he got nothing out of it. Just a pastor from Newfoundland that cared about this little maritime kid in Halifax trying to make a go of it. And he just invested in me. He listened to me.
Wow.
What a gift.
I don't know if it's appropriate to share, but can you share his name?
Yeah, his name was Paul Bailey.
Paul Bailey. And I just, man, it's like, if all of us could be aspire to be a Paul Bailey.
Oh, you know, it's funny, Jason, in retrospect, Paul never pastored a church the size I pastored in any of my contexts or anything. And Paul has since kind of left the ministry. I think he's a coach, consultant. I think he does that now and stuff. I saw him celebrate every win I got along the way. And, he taught me a lot just by his posture. His posture, yeah.
I love that.
I'm thankful for people like that.
It just goes a long way, and it's interesting, maybe leadership sounds like his bent, but maybe that he also just spotted that might be the area to call out to you. And I know sometimes we come alongside people and a little bit of listening, you go, okay, maybe it's theological formation. That's the gap here. Or maybe it's just courage. And they just need some encouragement. But just the discerning, the kind discerning voice of someone a little bit further along, not trying to change everything about you, not trying to make you like them, but to go, okay, this could be helpful and I'll put the time in. I just think what we need right now in our time is more advocates and coaches.
I think listening to, really listening to your younger leaders. Everybody needs to be heard and everybody has something of value to add. And taking time to stop by and listen to them. What is on their heart? What's moving them? What are they interested in? What are they worried about? Some of the best older leaders in my life have always just helped me. I remember going through something in Montreal and leading this church, and it was really dark and difficult moment in my life. And I talked to an older leader, another part of the country. I remember him just saying to me, he said, Jonathan, you're going to get through this.
Wow.
It wasn't profound. It wasn't this is what you need to do or anything. I just believed him. I believed him. I knew he had been through a lot and he had made it through it. And sometimes it's lending your strength of experience with not being prescriptive. I think sometimes older leaders can get prescriptive, and it's a different world younger leaders are leading in, a different context, and it's not always A to B initiatives like it may have been in my era when I was their age. But I think it's listening and less prescriptive. Again, what do they need? Like you say, what is it that they need at this moment? What can I backfill for them? Is there something I could lend them?
Yeah. I really appreciate your thoughtfulness, and you're so perceptive. I'm curious when you zoom out a little bit, whether you want to say for the Toronto area or the province, what are some things that you think churches, and it could be national, but I just know that the regions in Canada are so unique. What are you seeing as sort of the conversations we've got to be having? Some of them we've hit, but just curious, as you're thinking about leadership in this time and a multiplying church and, engage in the next generation. What are some of the questions? We've got to be wrestling with this. If we don't bring this up, whether it's with trusted friends or with our leadership teams, we're going to find ourselves kind of missing an important moment. Just curious, what are those things that have your attention or you're seeing on the horizon right now?
Emerging leaders. We need to be so intentional about giving them platforms and moments and development and protecting them.
What do you mean by protecting?
Protecting them from themselves, but also from the traps we fell into. We reaped a lot, and you hear all the sad stories, unfortunately, of leaders who don't finish well. And, I don't revel in any of them, and I don't like participating and talking about them even because, these are all human beings attached to families, but some of them have done grievous things too that have hurt others. And I can't help but think, where was the accountability network there? Where were the people in their lives? And, I'm a public person, but very private person too. And I can't afford, and this church can't afford for me to be ultra private. I need the accountability that will keep me protected. And I also think protection is also knowing how to step aside as a seasoned leader to make room for younger leaders. You protect them by giving them opportunity, even protect them from leaving for another pathway or leaving ministry circles because, there's a lot of people taking up room and space. But in our movement, we got the big retirements are coming. I'm early 50s, so I got a little ways to go, but I know that in our movement, the percentage of boomers that are going to retire leaving vacancies in pulpits across Canada is pretty palatable.
Yeah.
And sometimes we can find ourselves just operating as usual. I think we're in bigger crisis moments than most of us want to acknowledge. And it's because maybe situationally, I'm in a thriving church right now. So what does it have to do for me, with me? Or, you know, you've got a great church you guys have started there in Vancouver. But we can't afford to lose more expressions of the church.
No.
That are incarnationally deployed all over Vancouver, all over Toronto.
Yeah.
And some of them are really small expressions that are struggling.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that a lot of them, there is no succession plan. There is no one in the pipeline. And I just wonder what the stale date is on so many churches in our not just our movement, but in the churches across Canada. So I think we got a big collective problem that'll require a big collective response.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that conversation has to get elevated, and we have to have the courage to identify what's not working fully. You know, like somehow there's systems that we're investing in right now that are contributing positively to outcomes, but they're not robust enough to see healthy, mature, resilient leaders.
Ooh, that's really
for
good.
Our time.
That's really good, because you could be getting present day results that seem encouraging or that are adding, but reflecting on them long term, what is the, you know, they're immediate more. They're less an investment into the future. I think even what you guys are doing here with the Church Leaders Network, you guys are trying to fuel that in the vision for Canadian leaders. And I think every pastor should have some sort of strategic succession plan, at least in ideation form and development. Like we're doing something with our communicators right now. Like I believe in team teaching again. I think the congregation benefits from multiple voices, but I think also too, it keeps you in check too. Like
and gives you time to do all the other things.
It does. And I think your speaking gets better. There's a lot of things that can contribute to it. But like we recognize that there's content presenters and there's content producers, and sometimes they're the same people and sometimes they're not. And so we have a lot of younger leaders. We're developing the content presenting so that on our digital expressions, I can write it, the content for them. They can present it. Let them be the voice and face for this. And then developing them as content producers also. So we're working at developing our younger staff to be more the face of the church, to be able to engage with the community and city around us. But we want to help them win at it. And I recognize there are two different skill sets. And sometimes there's people like you, Jason, who embody both of those at the same time. They don't often develop at the same time equally. So I think some people through study, seminary and everything, the content producing gets developed quite well, and the content presenting can be a leftover attribute, and much to the detriment of your congregation has to listen to you. But sometimes you can model yourself. If you're just focused on content presenting, the problem is you'll probably find somebody else's voice, someone that inspires you, and you become like them and not your truest reflection of yourself. The content producing helps you with that. So we recognize there are two parts and we're trying to bring them together. But that's one way of elevating and giving opportunity to younger leaders with handlebars.
There's so many themes I'd love to chat with you more about. So we'll have to do this again. I'm so grateful for your time. Maybe last or second to last question. In your personal life right now, you've been following Jesus for a long time, and I know our spiritual rhythms will take different forms in different seasons. And I'm just curious, it's a really personal question. What is most life-giving? Like, what's a rhythm or a practice in this particular season, whether it's a quiet time practice or recreational practice? What's restoring and replenishing you the most? What's contributing to your health that is maybe unique in this season?
Yeah, that is pretty easy. I knew exactly where I'd go. Because I'm an active person physically, but also ideation. Like I love energy. I love movement. It's been meditation. And I take time every morning by myself for 10 to 15 minutes. And then I go into Lecto 365. Have you ever done that?
Yeah. From so I'll do that. 24/7 prayer guys.
Yeah, yeah. So I'll do that on the back end of that. So cool. I do that, and then I do that on the back end of it. And it doesn't replace my study, but it, I don't know what it is, Jason. There's something about not reading. Because when I read, I feel like I go into study mode so much. And yeah. I read to get and not to be. And I think it's been such a game changer in my life to slow down, slow my thinking, thoughtfully connect with my creator. Not ask for something, just be with him. That and probably therapy have been really life-giving in this season.
Can you tell me a bit more about the meditation practice? Because I know different people might have different images that come to mind, but yeah, what does that look like? You know, how do you bring yourself to quiet, and what do you actively engage your mind with, or what tools do you work with, or how do you structure even that time?
I went, I did a sabbatical this last year, and I went away to a Catholic retreat center, and I met with a priest every day, and he, St. Ignatius, we went through a lot of St. Ignatius' way of meditation, and I incorporated that into my life. It was so life-giving to me. It was helpful. So, you know, there's this aspect where St. Ignatius would have this practice, and every priest, Jesuit priest, does the same thing. They reflect on the day that was. They think, look for moments of consolation and moments of desolation. And they say you have to meditate on it because they often look the same. You can think a moment of like exhilaration for you could be, I told that person where to go and how to get there, and it feels really good. But that actually moved you further away from your creator. It was a moment of actual desolation. There are moments when you're going through difficult and hard times, and they're actually really moments of consolation, because it's just like Jesus suffering on the cross. They're actually leading you closer to the person of Jesus. So they don't always follow your feeling path. And so I think incorporating that meditation in the morning, as I reflect on the day that was, and then as I look into the day that will be. And so for me, it's both breathing practices. It's also introspective as I look back over the day, but it's also, before I even get to my petitions, it's acknowledging God's in the space with me, that he was occupied it before I arrived. He will be here after I leave. That there's this aspect of me just trying to fit in, even in the church or the leadership God's placed in my hand in the season. It's not my church, it's his. This is a moment in time. I'll leave someday. And he'll be here with his people. And there's a sense of like seeing yourself in the universe and your place. You feel small and you feel incredibly connected to what God is doing in this world. So it's small that your ego recognizes it doesn't all depend on you. He's bigger. He's better. He's stronger.
Yeah.
He sees better. And I think that meditation time takes that kind of form for me. It was very much formed from that Jesuit priest conversation.
Oh, that's beautiful. This week I've been thinking a bit about my spirituality as a teenager. My faith came alive very dynamically in high school. And I'd been in environments of singing and very charismatic Pentecostal environments and really sensing the presence of God. Like just incredible, even quiet times in my room. Music was a big part of it, but being alone in my room and listening to worship music and trying to understand the Bible, really meeting with Jesus. And it was, there's a certain kind of emotional engagement. It obviously, in retrospect, had a lot to do with that age and stage of life. And and then I've been thinking about how in some ways, some of my spirituality that got me through those first 5-10 years of following Jesus no longer sufficiently grounds me in him. And I'm not quite getting the language right, but being like, there's something about our bodies changing, our hormones changing, our ego changing, moving from that youthful ambition that God somehow graciously meets with to being hit with all the blows of life and, you know, your worldview has to expand and change. And just as you were chatting, I've just acknowledged in my own life how in some ways I feel like I'm still meeting the very same, of course, theologically I know this to be true, but even experientially, I'm meeting the same presence of God, but needing a very different toolkit to get there. Something that it's like I have, like similar to you, I'm having to carve out these quiet moments, and it's not the same as when I used to enter a room as a kid and the music singing, I met the presence of God there. It's like, whether it's his either design to take me deeper or just the nature of my now not youthful body, but adult body with adult experiences needing a new spirituality. And your reflections back, because this is really fresh thinking for me.
I mean,
me.
That's thoughtful, Jason. You know, you talked earlier about intergenerational team members, and you know, we have a span of I think 68 to 20 in our staff team, and every stage of life requires something different.
Yeah.
And it's a little bit like 30 years into marriage. Shell and I can sit in the same room and not talk and feel very connected.
Yeah.
We couldn't have done that when we were younger.
And sometimes that's the precious thing that would have been a threat to a dating relationship.
Right. Or even an early marriage one.
Yeah.
It just feels like you're desperate to connect. And I think too, sometimes there's a maturity that I think early on for me, I probably grew up in similar environments than as you did, Jason. It probably makes it harder for me to be in them sometimes. I have to be careful with my attitude and heart. I grew up in a strongly steeped holiness movement with lots of rules and a lot of emotive expressions. And I left the church for a season. And I often say it's my dad that was principal in bringing me back. I was an existentialist. I had my own philosophy and approach to life. And my dad really would engage me around questions instead of debating me. He really wanted to understand me. And he directed me towards the book of Ecclesiastes. And that was my journey back to faith was through Ecclesiastes of all books. But I think that age and stage and the way we engage, and I think that's why maybe some of the more traditional, older historic church practices interest me so much in this era.
Yeah.
It's not to despise what I grew up in. Well, I think it was all well-intended. And I think there was some good around that. The energy of when people ask me to describe what a Pentecostal is, I said, you know, I don't talk theology. I'll say there are people who lean in the gathering. They're expecting that God is here and God is going to do something and he's going to meet with us. So there's this expectancy in Pentecostal worship that I still to this day love.
Me too.
But in my own private like walk, I probably don't listen to worship music. I probably don't do a lot of things that people do in their, you know, other people find life-giving. They're not as life-giving to me. It's some of these other practices, being quiet. It's meditating on a scripture. It's smaller things that have helped me kind of charge that. But like, I love your thoughtfulness around, you know, just as your body's changed, as the stages have changed and some of the original practices that brought you life no longer bring you life.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's limited. I don't know.
Yeah. And I think I'm also trying to think about as a pastor being like, how do I?
Right.
Because I think the journey sometimes sounds like you can be quite harsh of a youthful idealism. And I'm like, I think we should be slow before we, like the thing that catalyzed me was like, you can reach your friends. God could change my whole school.
Right.
God healed people in the New Testament. He could heal my friend. And we saw miracles. Like it was like, there was this simple hermeneutic, this simple thing. Right. And somehow as pastors with five generations in our congregations and different life experiences coming from all the world to our cities, how do we invite people to a spirituality that's so robust that we don't like put preferential treatment on one type of expression while also helping people like not put shade on one over the other? Like that's right. Kind of what I'm thinking about. It's like, oh, the task of the pastor in a church is to lay out a spiritual formation journey that allows people for their unique wiring and different stages of life to not moralize one practice over another, but to be thoughtful and participatory in a very, I don't know, I'm still trying to find it, man.
But you model it so well, Jason. Like even, look, Daryl is one of your prime communicators at your church. I think he still is. An older veteran who comes with a different approach and way than maybe you would. Although I've heard you speak many times, I find it very thoughtful. and engaging, but I don't think I want to dampen too much of that youthful feistiness either, because I do think, you know, there's a reason why I think David faced Goliath when he was young. There's something about maybe not knowing that there's potential, or just feeling like we can do this. The simple faith that we'll go in and plant a church at 23, and not having taken a course and no church planting network behind you, you just did it.
Yeah.
Like, I had no business doing that. Where did that come from? Well, some of that was my brokenness, but a lot of that was youthful enthusiasm. And I just trusted that, you know, the gospel was strong enough to penetrate anyone's heart, change anyone's life. So why not?
Come on.
And the older version of Jonathan would tell you, well, there's a long list of reasons why maybe this wouldn't work. And I love it. That's why I like the younger staff. We tip young in our church unapologetically. And I love the vitality they bring to our seniors. We collide our seniors events with our children's ministry events, and they collectively work together on things. And that's all strategically around this idea of energizing our older and bringing safety and wisdom to our younger. But so I think even modeling it the way you do at your church is a great way to honor those different pathways and stages.
Well, Jonathan, I've taken more of your time than I think I asked for. It's been such a joy to be with you. Thanks for the work you're doing in your local context. But one thing I've always admired, and I saw this during the pandemic, is your heart to give it away and share it. Mm-hmm. And to be open-handed, to be generous with what you're learning and your tools. And so thanks for being a generous-hearted pastor in Canada. We're so grateful for you.
Oh, thanks, Jason. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you and anyone listening. And keep going, guys.
Come on. Well, thanks, Jonathan, for taking the time to share your story and wisdom with us today. And for everyone listening, thanks for spending time with us. Our desire is that you'd be strengthened and encouraged as you serve your local church today. And so tons of love from myself and the whole CCLN team. Bye for now.